Hey, everybody, this is Phil Town.
And this is Danielle Town.
And we're here for the Invested Podcast, where we're talking about how we're really breaking down how Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger have managed to do so well. And let's just start that over again.
Okay,
here we go. Take two. Three. Hey, everybody, this is Phil Town.
And this is Danielle Town.
And we're here for the Invested Podcast. Welcome. Where we're talking about how to invest the way Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger do it. I'm teaching my daughter.
How to invest. How does one do such a thing?
It does sound like that. Like the Twilight Zone.
So, and frankly, it takes a lot of information to find out how to do such a thing as long-term Buffett-style value investing.
Which it turns out is incredibly simple, but not easy.
This is like one of those movie trailers that's like, in a world far, far away.
I love it that it's incredibly simple and not easy, particularly right now. It is brutal. And and there's a reason for that. We're going to talk about that today because we're talking about Monash Prabhai's interview at Forbes magazine from June. And he gets right into that right away. And I'll tell you, there are times when investing the way I do it and the way I'm teaching Danielle and the way you guys are learning is tough to do because it's tough to be patient.
Well, it's not tough to, I have to disagree. It's not tough to do. It's not tough to practice investing and study and read and learn about companies. It's actually, in my opinion, a really good time to do that. But what's tough to do is find companies at good prices.
Yeah, there is the truth of it, right? There's the sticky part. And by way of looking historically, there are also times in my experience where it is literally like shooting fish in a barrel and first you drain the water. I mean, it's just sometimes ridiculously easy, simple and easy. Right now, it's simple and not easy. Because as Danielle said, it's tough to find companies that are on sale that we understand and we like. And that is the subject we want to discuss today because Monash Prabhai was talking about that in this Forbes article.
Yeah. So this is, I think it might not be in the actual magazine, Dad. I think it might only be online, but I'm not sure.
Oh,
but you can definitely find it online. It's an interview with Monash Prabhai, P-A-B-R-A-I. And if you just search Forbes or Monash Prabhai, it should come up. And it is from June 25th, 2018. It's an interview with a guy called Kevin Harris. So that's the one. And he just gave this really lovely, not very long, but very deep interview about the way he invests, about what he's doing now, and really about how he approaches his own investing practice is how I took it. It's pretty cool. We'll get into it, but he talks a lot about doing it on his own and not really being influenced or depending on anybody else. And that's something that I think I connected to that so much because that's what I'm doing now with this kind of investing style.
Well, one of the things I thought that Kevin in his interview brought out from Monash was a question really to the point of, how does value investing change over time, right? Mm. What we're calling rule one style investing, which honestly, I don't think is the same thing as value investing. I don't think Monash, I know I'm not, and I don't think Monash is a value investor per se, but we're going to use that term because that's the way the world's calling it, okay?
Yeah, I mean, I know that you've said that a lot and I've questioned you about it a lot because I think the term has changed. I think it has become what Warren Buffett has made it.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so, honey. I look at people who call themselves value investors and there are many, many, many of them. And I would say the vast majority of them aren't really much different than your typical mutual fund manager. In fact, I bet you could find well over 400 or 500 mutual funds that call themselves value funds.
And I gotta look this up.
They're not value.
See what this looks like.
They're not value investors in the tradition of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger and Monash Prabhai and me. These guys are they call themselves value investors because what they're doing is they're going out and trying to find companies that have a low PE ratio. And they buy 200 or 300 of them. So I guess in all fairness, they could call themselves value investors in the tradition of Ben Graham, who bought 200 or 300 companies at a time and kind of founded value investing. So I would say they're more in Graham's terms value investors than Buffett and Munger. I don't think Buffett and Munger are really value investors per se. And I'll make that argument by saying that Charlie changed Warren's view of this back in the early 1960s by saying, look, it's better to buy a wonderful business at a fair price than a fair business at a wonderful price. And what value investors try to do is buy wonderful price businesses, right? They're just super cheap businesses. And then they'll buy 200 of them because they don't know which ones are going to fail.
Hmm.
Whereas Buffett and Munger buy six businesses or eight, you know, and they want to make sure they're good.
Or they're very certain. They're very, what's almost certain, but not quite. There should be a word for that.
Warren says certain with no.
I know he does, but
no
I can't say
conditions.
That. I cannot say that.
Well, the SEC certainly doesn't want to let you say that. That's for sure. But here's a quote from Buffett, basically more or less a quote that says, if you buy a wonderful business at a fair price, you are certain to make money. He said, it's no different than buying a $10 bill for $5. You're going to make money. You're going to be able to turn it into that $10 at some point. And this is what Manesh is saying in this article, is that these companies that he's buying are so cheap relative to their value. He makes the point that he's buying Fiat Chrysler back 6 years ago, that they were projecting to be at $5 a share by 2018. Right. This is their projection was going to be at $5 a share for earnings, and the stock was $5. So he said, if you can buy a company at 1x earnings of the future earnings, you're doing pretty good. You know, you're probably going to be okay. And does that make sense to you? I'm seeing you kind of roll your eyeballs here.
I feel like maybe the words got mixed up because I think what you were trying to say is that the company's earnings were $5 a share.
Right. What did I say?
I don't know. I don't know what you actually said, but what I heard was that their stock price is $5 a share at the time and that they were projecting that their stock price would be $5 per share in 2018.
And then I misspoke.
But I don't know if you did, but that's what I heard. So what you're saying is there's a difference between stock price and earnings per share, and their earnings per share
was projected to be $5 in 2018.
Projected to be $5 right. in 2018.
Right. So Sergio Marconi, who's the CEO, was saying, we're going to be at $5 per share earnings in 5 years or 4 years or whatever it was. And what Monesh was saying is that if he could buy that stock for $5 per share, when 4 or 5 years from now, it was going to be selling for some price X, and it would have
some
earnings of $5 a share.
Of the earnings per share.
It was almost certainly going to have a multiple of more than one, right? And if it had a multiple of 2, it would mean that Monesh would double his money in 5 years.
Got it.
A multiple of 2. But it's much more likely to have a multiple of 14 or 16, right? So can you imagine how well you would do if, in fact, it turned out to have a multiple of 14 or 16 5 years later with $5 of earnings? You'd make a huge amount of money. And that's exactly what happened.
Hmm.
He made like 800% on that stock in 5 years.
Yeah.
And
he's so like chill about it. He's just like, we did well. I was pretty happy with that one.
Yeah. That was a really good investment. I looked at that very, very closely because I knew he was in it. I didn't know he was in it until Fiat Chrysler stock price had doubled to $11 a share from where Monesh bought it. And there's always this tendency to feel like you got too late, right? You found out the information way too late.
Yeah.
And now you hesitate to move in, even though a great investor is in there because he got in at so much of a better price. But honestly, I was looking at Fiat Chrysler at $11 a share before they split off Ferrari. And effectively, what they've done is they've split off a company that Monesh bought, I think, at, I don't know, $5 or $6 billion of market value. And they spun off Ferrari and got $20 billion of market value just for Ferrari. And then currently the rest of the company is worth $20 billion. His point is you're going to have an opportunity to buy great companies. And my point is you're going to have an opportunity to buy great companies for many, many years. And it's sometimes a mistake. It's often a mistake to assume just because it was really cheap 5 years ago, it's not cheap today. That would be the point.
That's a good point, because there is a real feeling of I'm late. I feel that, I would say, with like every single company that I look at, because the only reason it even comes to my attention is that maybe it's like an interesting company that maybe could be like decently priced, but probably I found out about it because somebody else discovered it 6 months earlier, and that's always late.
Sure. And you're always going to feel one of two things when you see that some really good investor that you trust has bought this company at $5 and now it's 11. Okay. You're going to feel one of two things. If it's 11, you're going to feel like I missed the boat. And if it's at 4, you're going to feel like maybe they're wrong.
Yeah.
Right. You're like, oh man, he bought it at 5 and now it's at 4. Maybe he made a mistake. And that's
a legitimate fear. No, you're going to feel really good about yourself because you're going to be like, oh yeah, I missed that one. Oh.
Yeah, and it went down.
Right? Yeah.
And it went down. And that's why it's not possible realistically to just simply copy Monash Prabhai or copy Warren Buffett, because these guys do make mistakes. They do have times when they buy something they think is on sale and it turns out it's got problems and it goes into big trouble and you don't know when they exit and they get out and then you're stuck with it. And meanwhile, you're just hoping it goes up and you don't really understand what you bought. And as a result, you end up in a big emotional quandary, and that's a terrible place to be. If you've ever bought anything because somebody else bought it and you just jumped in with it and then it went down, that is a nightmare emotional feeling.
Oh my God,
feeling.
Horrible. The pain.
But
this is what I mean when you say Warren Buffett says that you are certain and it's impossible to lose money. No, it's always possible to lose money. There are circumstances beyond our control. I'm sorry to inform you about this, Dad. I don't care if you've gone through your checklist and you've done everything. Like, we have to be aware and able to work through and live through moments where things go wrong that are through no fault of our own. And that happens with companies. Companies are run by people, and people screw up, and people make bad decisions, and people steal, and people don't predict terrorist attacks, and people don't predict airline crashes, and all kinds of things can happen. So,
which makes it sound scary, doesn't it?
Clearly, this is very important to me because I have to be ready for that. Like, this certain thing means that there will be a time when I don't know how to handle the fact that my certainty created a bad situation.
Well, the first thing you're going to do to handle that is to have a strategy for investing similar to what Monash was talking about in this article. And that is, you're going to own more than one thing.
Right. You're going to own more than one thing. Two, I'll answer my own point.
Mm-hmm.
I'll know that my certainty actually didn't create this situation, that I controlled everything I could control and knew I did everything I could do. And the other 1% of life is simply beyond me. And what I have to do then is come back to my investing practice and work through it emotionally, be comfortable with it, have the other companies, as you just said, and continue on and be aware that this is probably part of what's going to happen. We make mistakes.
Yep. And there will be a mistake. I mean, there's no question. I don't know any investors who have not made a mistake, including Charlie and Warren. But in the long run, if you follow this investing strategy that Monash is talking about in this article, you're going to do well. It's going to come out well. So the first basic that he was talking about in here that was really fascinating was that, of course, he's looking for companies that are on sale, and he owns no companies in the United States right now.
Yes, we're finally getting to this.
Companies,
we ended last time. We're finally getting to it.
Yep.
Yeah, he doesn't own any U.S. companies, which is a really surprising thing for a U.S. investor.
Well, yes and no. I mean, if you think about it, Buffett is sitting there with a bunch of U.S. companies that he bought over many years, right? So he owns U.S. companies. But if you look at the companies he's been buying lately, he's bought, really, to my knowledge, he's bought one, maybe two companies in the last 2 or 3 years that he's gotten seriously into. The most important one that comes to mind is, of course, Apple Computer, which he's bought very, very aggressively in the last 6 months, to a point where he owns a huge chunk of Apple now. And so, of course, you know, Buffett has one or two, so there's some there. But in general, he's sitting in a pile of cash. And Pabrai is taking a different perspective. Instead of staying with U.S. companies and not putting money into the market at all, which is what Buffett's doing, he has branched out overseas. And he's bought a bunch of different companies. He's talking about Fiat Chrysler that he bought 6 years ago, but which he continues to own, and which he thinks is going to continue to go up substantially. And this is why you have to do your homework, hon, is because the CEO of Fiat Chrysler just got very, very ill and stepped down just in the last week. And now you have to wonder, okay, well, this genius has been running this thing and turning it around since Fiat bought Chrysler almost out of bankruptcy. And will the next guys in line do as well? Right.
Yeah. Well, and people have been wondering that for a while because he's been talking about retiring for a while.
Right. Sort of planning next year to retire.
But he hasn't. Yeah. But he hasn't named a successor. So it's as by the time this podcast comes out, they may have named a successor.
They did.
Then.
They did.
Oh.
Yep.
They did.
Yep. The guy that was running Jeep and Ram.
Oh,
trucks.
You're right. I read that and I forgot it. Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
So a new guy has taken over.
Is there like prize pig, basically?
It is.
They love Jeep over there.
It is. And they're planning on really, really, I mean, basically Chrysler stopped making sedans almost completely now.
Well, good, because they're hideous.
They were hideous. And Jeep, I'm not a huge fan of, but I am a huge fan of Ram trucks. I own two of them, and I love them compared to Fords. So I get it, why they're doing very well with that. And they're going to really expand the Jeep line. Maybe the Jeep line is better than... I owned a Jeep back when you were a little baby.
I know.
That was the biggest piece of crap car I've ever owned.
I've always
owned.
Heard about what a piece of crap car that was. It annoys you to this day.
To this day. I shut the hood after I checked oil or something. I put the hood down without slamming it or anything, and I bent it in half. It buckled at the hinge. Oh my god.
And these things get ingrained in you, because my husband said that he wanted a Jeep, and my first, because he's European and to him Jeeps are like cool and American, and I was just like, oh my god, we can't get a Jeep. Crap car. And he goes, oh, you've done your research? And I was like, no,
it's just what my dad said. From
actually have no idea if it's a good car or not.
30 years ago it wasn't
30
a good
years
car.
Ago yeah we still don't have one though. So so it's really interesting that Munish Pabrai has taken himself completely out of the U.S. is looking in other markets where he can really find mispricing, and he uses that word mispricing, which is what he did with Fiat Chrysler. He found that mispricing that you were talking about between the earnings per share and the price of the stock.
Right.
And he's just not finding that in the U.S. right now.
But I got to say, you know, Monash is Indian, and so like an expat has already a worldview, right? Because he's living in America.
Yeah.
He's from India. It's a lot easier for a guy like that to feel comfortable looking into Indian companies than it would be for me. And I've lived in India for little chunks of time in the past. I feel very comfortable in India and I love India, but I'm a little bit intimidated by the ability of Indian companies to get around the accounting rules of American accounting. And Monash makes this point in this article that he has to know which are the auditor companies which are trustworthy and which are not.
Oh, that's
And so he knows that. And he's got a list of companies that he's added to his checklist, a list of auditing companies. And if he sees a company that they're auditing, that's an immediate red flag, because they have been involved in scams in the past where fraudulent companies were audited by them and said to be good.
Yeah, that's interesting. You got to know what you're about.
You got to know what you're about. And that is where Warren and Monash would part company, is that Warren and Charlie don't feel particularly comfortable investing in a significant number of companies overseas. And they have done it. Warren bought the Chinese petroleum company for a short period of time. He just thought it was a really mispriced deal. And he owned it for like 2 years and got out. They've bought this BYD battery company that they think is run by this genius in China. He's owned a steel company in Korea, which turned out to be a mistake, and they got out of that. But in general, I got to say, Warren just stays in America. He walks his talk, right? And his talk is stick with America.
Yeah, I think he's a real homebody guy in every way.
Yep.
He stays where he grew up, and he invests where he grows up, where he grew up. We invest where he knows.
But this is the difference between Warren and Charlie and Monash. Okay, so we're talking to guys that are in the same investing strategy. I mean, Monash learned his strategy from Buffett and Munger, but Buffett and Munger don't have to answer to investors at all. They don't care what the investors have to say much at all, and are willing to sit in cash for years. You know, maybe they'll give some money back as a dividend that they've never done before. But basically, they're not listening to investors moan about not having a good return. They're not running a fund. Okay.
Right. Right.
Whereas Monash is running a fund and to some degree has to stay invested, or these big money people are going to pull their money out. So he's under a certain amount of pressure.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So you're trying to say that Buffett and Munger can sit around and
do nothing,
not purchase anything new.
Right.
Whereas
waiting for the American market to turn.
Maybe Pabrai got, in a sense, pushed out to these other countries that he wouldn't have otherwise, have gone to.
Maybe. I'm not 100% positive, but you remember our interview with Guy Spier where Guy said he just tries to stay invested, right?
Yeah.
This is a very different strategy than Buffett and Munger. And this is a strategy being driven by what I would call the institutional imperative, which is...
Yeah, but I don't like that you're characterizing it that way, because he's saying that he's finding very interesting companies in markets that have been flatlining for a long time and that there's a real mispricing that he's finding.
There is, but he's dealing with a level, and he says he's not a macro investor. And this is really important that if he's not a macro investor, then essentially he's ignoring the macroeconomic environment of India. And that's dangerous. I mean, if you're going to ignore the macro investment situation environment of India, you're ignoring some really major issues with the Indian market.
Hold on.
Okay.
You tell me all the time to ignore the macro situation and that I should just find companies. And if I can find them at a good price that's on sale and they're wonderful companies and they meet all the criteria, then it doesn't matter what's happening in the macro market, because I will have already bought it at a great price. And if it goes down, then awesome, I can buy some more.
Yes. And we're talking about America. Predominantly talking about America. And America has a very resilient economic engine. We're a strongly capitalist nation with very, very good structure and rules, very good, honest regulation, honest accounting by the most part. And you can count on the American dream to continue, that the country will continue to grow. We're the biggest economic engine in the world, and we will continue to grow. So if you're buying into a company in America, you're basically buying into the overall American macroeconomic situation. When you buy a company in India, you're buying into the Indian macro situation.
I got you.
You see what I'm saying?
It's a very fair point. That's a very, I'm glad that you
And I'll tell you, I've got a very good friend of mine who you know, but I won't mention his name, who shifted his investments out of America into India and got smoked. And he's a good value investor, and he bought companies that he thought were on sale, and he ended up getting crunched by a change in the value of the currency against the dollar, in dealing with really onerous Indian regulation and culture that's there that is bureaucratic to the max and inhibits the growth of companies that should grow. And as a result, you can buy in there and you get these super good looking deals, and they just stay good looking deals. They never get up. And I'm not saying that's going to happen to Monash. He's obviously a much, much more informed investor about India than my friend was. But I'm not that informed about India. And I would say, by and large, most people listening to the podcast would be very, very well served to be investing in a culture and economic environment that they really understand.
He also, it's a great point. I'm really glad that you made it, in the sense that, so how can we put this right? It's not, we're not investing based on the macroeconomic situation. That's what you've been teaching me. I think that's right. But we are conscious of into what market we are buying, literally. Yep. Yep. Into what market? What Yep. is this stock exchange
Right.
that we're buying into?
Right.
What kinds of standards do they uphold? Can we trust the information coming out of it? And do they change them regularly, or is it reliable? Like, all those kinds of really legal questions that I think are fascinating.
That is, it is fascinating. And Monash is making an expanded argument, maybe a little bit to support his idea of moving outside the U.S. by saying in this article that the number of public stocks have shrunk radically over the last number of years.
In the U.S.,
by about 50%.
Yeah, it's something we've made that point on the podcast before. I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah.
There's so many fewer public companies the U.S.
Yep. And this is, of course, the result of the larger environment that these companies are being formed in. And a couple of things that have changed over time. One is that the pool of capital now for private companies, private equity capital and venture capital, and this giant capital pool.
For private companies.
Yeah, means that they can get access to growth capital without giving up a huge chunk of the company, and maybe on the same terms that they could get by going public. And they don't have to deal with the public regulations and the oversight and the disclosures you have to make and telling everybody about your business all day long, which is actually an enormous disadvantage.
And you don't have to do quarterly earnings projections.
Right.
You don't have to do all of that short-term stuff. Maybe you do for your private investors, but it's a different kinds of thing. You don't have to focus on that short-term stuff, which so many companies find a waste of time.
Oh, and then your CEO and your chief financial officer have to sign on the dotted line that everything in the accounting report is exactly right. And often that's difficult for these guys to do, you know, to know that deep, the details. Mm-hmm. And when they sign that, they could go to jail if they're wrong. And so all of this creates a kind of an onerous environment it's really a combination. I mean, companies would still go public like crazy in spite of regulations, and they always have, if they need the capital. But what has really encouraged companies not to go is suddenly we have an enormous billions and billions of dollars available for companies to stay private. And that's quite different than it used to be.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point.
Yep.
And I want to ask you what I was about to get to before we got off on that, which is Monish Pabrai says that he also is investing in South Korea and Japan, which are very different macro situations than India. They're both highly developed countries, highly developed economies, extremely Western friendly.
Yep. How would you
think about those compared to the U.S.? I would imagine they'd be in a sort of different category for you than India would.
Yeah, it is. They are a different category. They're not, sort of oppressed by bureaucracy and culture that fights against entrepreneurship. These are both very entrepreneurial type countries, and both have been crushed for various reasons in terms of their stock market.
Which is why he was looking at them, because they've been crushed for a long time.
Yep.
And he thinks they still have good companies in there.
Yep. And he's probably right. I mean, if you could figure out how to go into Japan and buy public companies at a decent price, you could probably do very well. The question is whether you're going to be able to really know what's going on. I mean, can you really know what's going on in a company that's producing everything in Japanese and nothing in English? And, you know, how do you know what the heck you're looking at?
mean, unless you're fluent in Japanese, that's going to be a tall order.
Exactly. Yeah. So the point being,
I'm kind of assuming they produce some documents in English.
Well, some companies do, but they don't have to.
No, of course.
If they're really local company, they don't have to produce it in English any more than we have to produce ours in Japanese.
Yeah.
So I first off, I want to say that Monish is a really smart guy, and he is very comfortable on the world stage and very comfortable with his investing analysis process, which, you know, I think we should get into a little bit, because he talks about not the disadvantages of working with a group of people as a standalone investor, and makes the point that Warren Buffett is managing 80 some companies that are reporting to him and a $160 billion portfolio, and he does it all without any analysts helping him. And if Buffett can do that, the rest of us certainly can do our little bit. So next time, let's talk about that.
Do our little bit is the important part of that.
Yeah, I'm doing our little bit. Let's talk about that. How Pabrai looks at doing investing research.
Yeah, and how he looks at research, how he structures it with, as you said, people or no people, and also his checklist
He's
written about extensively, and he talks about again in this interview.
The one we'd all like to see.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's talk about that next time.
All right.
Until then, time to go.
Thanks,
everybody.
See ya. Bye.
Hey, guys, thanks for listening to Invested. Looking for a deep dive into the principles we discuss on this podcast? Well, then you may have to just check out our free online course. Yep, free. Called the Intro to Rule Number One. The course teaches you the basics of Rule Number One investing, and I want you to take advantage of this 5-lesson video course just by visiting investedpodcast.com/course. All there for you for free. If you enjoyed this episode and want more information, including show notes and more episodes, visit us at investedpodcast.com. Everything discussed on this podcast is either my opinion or Danielle's opinion, and is not to be taken as investing advice, because I am not your investment advisor, nor have I considered your personal situation as your fiduciary. This podcast is for your entertainment and education only, and I hope you enjoyed it.